The monster's three heads looked up. The chimera had never eaten a marshmallow before. They were incredibly hard to get in Tartarus. Sure enough, the mortal hero did appear to have a giant gray marshmallow on a stick. The chimera's three little brains had a brief argument over the pros and cons of accepting marshmallows from strangers. Bellerophon was only 10 feet away when the goat head decided this was some sort of trick. Its mouth opened to melt Bellerophon's face off, but the hero chucked his lead on a stick right down the goat's fiery throat. Pegasus veered to one side as the goat head choked, molten lead filling its lungs. The chimera staggered. The lion and snake heads writhed in pain. Bellerophon jumped from Pegasus's back and drew a sword. Amazingly, he managed to do this without stabbing himself. For the first time, Bellerophon felt like a true hero with working reflexes and motor coordination and everything. As the chimera reared on its hind legs, ready to pounce, Bellerophon lunged underneath and drove his sword through the monster's belly. The chimera collapsed, its rear-end rattlesnake head still thrashing. "Booyah!" shouted Bellerophon. He held up his hand to high-five Pegasus. The horse looked at him like, "Please!" For a souvenir, Bellerophon cut off the chimera's goat head with its steaming lead-coated mouth. He took a couple of selfies with the monster's corpse. Then he rode Pegasus back to Lycia to tell King Iobates the good news. The king was delighted that the chimera was dead, but he was shocked that Bellerophon had come back alive.
"Now what am I supposed to do?"
Iobates wondered aloud. Bellerophon frowned.
"Your Majesty?"
"I mean, how can I possibly thank you enough? Well done."
That night, the king threw a big party in Bellerophon's honor. They had cake and ice cream and clowns and magicians, though the king nixed the fire swallowers as being in bad taste after the chimera incident. Iobates and Bellerophon talked through the night. The king decided he truly liked this young hero. Iobates didn't want to see him die, but he also wasn't quite ready to dismiss his daughter Antaea's letter asking for Bellerophon's execution. Why? Maybe Iobates was worried that Bellerophon could present a threat to the kingdom, or maybe Iobates was just a dad who hated saying no to his children, even if his children were sociopaths. Whatever the case, the king decided to give Bellerophon another challenge, just to make sure the fates really wanted this hero alive.
"You know, Bellerophon," he said over dessert, "I have no right to ask you any more favors, but..."
"Anything, my lord."
Bellerophon meant it, too. He'd never felt like a hero before, and he enjoyed it. The people loved him. The king's beautiful youngest daughter, Philonoe, had been flirting with him shamelessly, and he liked that, too. Most importantly, Iobates believed in him. The king had given Bellerophon a chance to prove himself. What a great guy.
"If I can help you in any way," Bellerophon said, "I will do it. Just name the favor."
The crowd applauded and raised their glasses to Bellerophon. Iobates felt like a real jerk, but he forced a smile.
"Well, this neighboring tribe, the Salamoi, they've been causing all sorts of trouble on our eastern border. The chimera killed my best men, except for you, of course, so I don't have much of an army. I'm afraid the Salamoi will overrun the whole country if they're not stopped."
"Say no more," said Bellerophon. "I will fly over there tomorrow and sort things out."
The crowd cheered. Princess Philonoe batted her eyelashes. Iobates heaped praise on the young hero, but inside, the king felt bad. The Salamoi had never been conquered. They were blessed by the war god Ares. In battle, they were absolutely fearless. Sending one guy to deal with them, that was suicide. The next day, Bellerophon hopped on Pegasus and flew off to fight the neighbors. Maybe he surprised them from the air. Maybe he just found his self-confidence the way Athena had advised him. Iobates believed in him, so he believed in himself. Anyway, Bellerophon landed in the middle of the Salamoi camp and slaughtered them. After Bellerophon killed about half the tribe and threw the rest into a panic, the chieftain begged for peace. He promised never to attack Lycia again. He and Bellerophon signed a peace treaty and took a few selfies together for posterity. Then Bellerophon flew back to the palace. Again, King Iobates was amazed. The people of Lycia went wild with joy. That night they held another victory celebration. The princess Philonoe flirted with the young Corinthian and begged her father to arrange a marriage for them. Iobates was torn. Bellerophon was turning out to be super helpful. He was brave and strong and truly blameless. He hadn't had a single accident since arriving in Lycia. No relatives killed, no dining halls burned down, not so much as an empty ship launched. Still, Antaea had asked for the young man's death, and Iobates had trouble denying his homicidal eldest daughter anything. He decided to give Bellerophon one more dangerous challenge just to be absolutely 100% sure the hero had the fates on his side.
"My wonderful friend Bellerophon," said the king, "I hate to ask, but there is one more threat to this kingdom. No, it's too dangerous, even for such a hero as you."
"Name it," Bellerophon said.
The crowd cheered wildly and banged their cups on the tables.
"Well," said Iobates, "this particular nation is making war on all the cities of Anatolia. Perhaps you've heard of the Amazons?"
The cheering died down. Bellerophon gulped. He had heard legends about the Amazons, all right. The name alone gave Greek children nightmares.
You want me to fight them?"
"I wouldn't trust anyone else with this mission,"
Iobates said, which was true.
"If you could just get them to back off, like you did with the Salamoi, that would be amazing."
The next day, Bellerophon flew off to battle. He couldn't believe he would be facing the Amazons, but Iobates believed in him, and Bellerophon couldn't let him down. Bellerophon flew straight into the Amazon encampment. He laid waste to their army. The Amazons were paralyzed by shock. They simply couldn't believe one stupid male could be so brave. By the time the Amazon queen was able to restore order, Bellerophon had killed hundreds of her best warriors. The queen called for a truce. Bellerophon agreed to leave the Amazons alone if they stopped raiding Lycia. The Amazons signed a peace treaty, which they rarely did, but they respected bravery, and Bellerophon the Blameless obviously had it. The Amazons wouldn't take any photos with him, but that was okay. Bellerophon flew back to the palace in high spirits. When he knelt before the king and announced his victory, Iobates did something unexpected. The old man burst into tears. He slipped out of his throne, clasped Bellerophon's ankles, and blubbered,
"Forgive me, my boy. Forgive me."
Sure, Bellerophon said. "What did you do?"
Iobates confessed the whole thing about Proetus's death warrant. He showed Bellerophon the letter. He explained that the quests had really been attempts to honor his daughter's wishes and get Bellerophon killed. The hero might have gotten angry. Instead, he pulled the king to his feet.
"I forgive you," Bellerophon said. "Rather than kill me outright, you gave me chances to prove myself. You made me a true hero. How could I be mad about that?"
"My dear boy."
Iobates was so grateful he arranged for Bellerophon to marry his daughter Philonoe. Bellerophon was named heir to the throne. Years later, when Iobates died, Bellerophon became the king of Lycia. As for Antaea, she never got her revenge. When she heard that Bellerophon had married her younger sister and taken over her father's kingdom, she was so upset, she killed herself. And they lived happily ever after. Ha ha ha. Not really. By now you've heard enough of these stories to know better. Bellerophon had one more major screw-up to get out of his system. After he'd been king for many years, Bellerophon started to miss the good old days. The crowds didn't cheer for him like they used to when he killed the Chimera. Nobody remembered the way he defeated the Salamoi and the Amazons. When he told those stories at the royal banquets, his guests stifled their yawns. Even his wife, Philonoe, rolled her eyes. Funny how that happens. New heroes come along. The old ones are tossed aside. We forget the bad stuff from the past. We get nostalgic for the good old days, burning down palaces, getting sentenced to death by crazed queens. Bellerophon decided he needed one more adventure, a midlife crisis quest to make everybody love him again and put some spice back in his life. He would fly higher than any hero had ever gone. He would visit the gods on Mount Olympus. He went to the palace's highest balcony and whistled for Pegasus. The winged horse answered his call. They hadn't seen each other in years. Pegasus looked no different, being immortal, but the horse was kind of shocked by how much Bellerophon had aged. Pegasus tilted his head. "What's up?"
"Oh, my friend," said Bellerophon. "We have one more quest to complete."
Bellerophon climbed on his back and took the golden reins. Pegasus flew skyward, thinking they were off to fight Amazons or something. Bellerophon spurred him in the wrong direction, west. Soon, they were racing over the Aegean Sea, climbing into the clouds. Pegasus whinnied like,
"Where are we going?"
"Mount Olympus, my friend," Bellerophon cried with glee. "We're off to see the gods."
Pegasus grunted and tried to turn. He'd flown to Mount Olympus before and knew it was restricted airspace. Mortals definitely did not have clearance. Bellerophon held the reins steady. He forced Pegasus to fly higher and higher against his will. They'd always had a balanced relationship, the horse and Bellerophon, but now Bellerophon was calling the shots. He'd forgotten Athena's warning from years ago.
"Don't push your luck. Don't do that."
All Bellerophon could think about was the glory he would achieve when he returned home with stories about the gods and maybe some souvenirs for the kids. Meanwhile, on Mount Olympus, Hermes was standing on one of the balconies, enjoying a nectar frappe, when he saw Bellerophon winging his way up from the earth.
Zeus, called the messenger god, "were you expecting a delivery?"
Zeus joined him on the balcony.
"Who is that? And why is he flying this way with that stupid grin on his face? Ganymede, fetch me a lightning bolt."
Hermes cleared his throat.
"Ganymede is on lunch break, Lord Zeus. You want me to fly down there and smack the guy?"
"No," Zeus grumbled. "I have another idea."
Zeus pulled a small tuft of vapor from the nearest cloud and fashioned a new kind of insect, the gadfly. If you've never seen one, you're lucky. It's basically the biggest, ugliest housefly you can imagine, crossed with the nastiest, most bloodthirsty mosquito. It has razor-sharp mandibles designed to rip into horse flesh, which is why it's sometimes called a horsefly. Zeus sent this new little bloodsucker down for its first meal. The gadfly bit Pegasus right between the eyes. Pegasus was immortal, but he could still feel pain. The gadfly's bite was the worst thing he'd experienced since getting singed by super goat flame breath. The winged horse bucked violently. Bellerophon lost the reins. He fell off and plummeted several thousand feet to his death. Pegasus felt bad about that, but come on. Bellerophon should have known better than to fly to Mount Olympus. All it got him was an embarrassing death, and now the rest of us have to deal with gadflies. On the bright side, Bellerophon and Philonoe had three wonderful children. Of course, their oldest son, Isandros, was later killed by Ares. Oh, and their oldest daughter, Laodamia, was killed by Artemis. Their youngest son, Hippolochus, he lived. But of course, his son, Glaucus, named after the old king of Corinth, was skewered by Ajax in the Trojan War. So yeah, Basically, Bellerophon and everybody related to him was murdered. The end. And if you don't like it, remember, I didn't make any of this up. You can just call me Percy the Blameless. It's totally not my fault. Serene punches a lion. No actual lions were harmed in the making of this myth. As a demigod, I get a lot of questions. Can titans have demigod children? Has a mortal ever fallen in love with two different gods? What's the proper way to kill a lion with your bare hands? Serene is great, because her story answers all that and more. She was born in Thessaly, part of northern Greece. You might remember her tribe, the Lapiths, from Theseus' story. They liked partying, killing centaurs, watching Sunday football, and destroying entire nations. The Lapiths were rough and rugged, so Serene grew up preferring spears to Barbie dolls and swords to Disney movies. Her friends knew better than to sing that song from Frozen, or she would pummel them unconscious. I like Serene. When she was young, her dad, Hypsias, possibly a.k.a. the hipster, became king of the Lapiths. His grandfather was Oceanus, the titan of the seas, which proves that titans can have demigod children, and Hypsias' dad was a river spirit. With those two godly connections, it's no wonder that Serene's body was made up of more than 60% water. That's a higher percentage than the average human. Not that I'm judging. I've got plenty of salt water in my system. Annabeth says most of that salt water is in my head. Very funny, wise girl. Anyway, Serene grew up dreaming of war and conquest. She wanted to be a great fighter like her dad. She wanted to spend every Saturday slaughtering centaurs and every Sunday watching football with the guys. Unfortunately, Lapith women weren't allowed to do any of the fun stuff.
Men wage war, said her father. Women stay home. Just watch the sheep while I'm gone.
I don't want to watch the sheep, Serene grumbled. Sheep are boring.
Daughter, he said sternly, if no one is there to guard the flock, the sheep will get eaten by wild animals.
Serene perked up. Wild animals?
Yes, bears, lions, wolves, occasionally dragons, all sorts of dangerous animals would love to eat our livestock.
Serene grabbed her spear and her sword. I think I'll watch the sheep. And so, while King Hipster was off waging war against the neighbors, Serene stayed home and waged war against wild animals. She had plenty to choose from. Back then, the hills and forests of Greece were full of vicious predators. Cougars, bears, mutant badgers, you name it. Serene didn't wait for the predators to attack her sheep either. While her flock was grazing the craggy, windswept valleys, she patrolled the surrounding hills, seeking out and destroying any potential threat. She killed bears that were 3 times her size. She considered it a boring day if she didn't fight at least one dragon before lunchtime. She nearly drove the mutant badger population to extinction. Serene got addicted to danger. Her friends would invite her to parties and she'd say, "Nah, I think I'll go kill some pumas." "You did that last night," her friends would complain. Serene didn't care. She barely slept or ate. She spent most of her time in the wilderness with her flocks, returning to the village only when she had to. She was so good at her job, the villagers eventually asked her to watch the cattle as well as the sheep. Serene was glad to. That meant more enticing targets for predators. She drove her herds to dangerous places, hoping to attract bigger and badder monsters to fight. The sheep and cows weren't even worried about it. They trusted Serene completely. One cow would get a whiff of danger and ask another cow,
"What's that?"
"Oh," the second cow would say,
"that's just a pack of wolves. Won't they eat us? Should we panic and stampede?" "No," said the second cow. "Watch."
Serene came hurtling out of the darkness, wailing like a banshee, and slaughtered the entire wolf pack.
"Oh, cool," said the first cow. "Yeah, she's awesome. Want to chew some more cud?
Serene was such a great hunter that Artemis herself took notice. The goddess gave her 2 fine hunting dogs as gifts. She tried to recruit Serene to join her followers, but Serene wasn't wild about being a maiden her entire life.
I'm honored and all, Serene said, but I like hunting alone. I'm not sure how I do in a big group. Also, I'd kind of like to get married someday.
Artemis wrinkled her nose in distaste.
Sorry to hear that. You've got talent. Here, take a brochure, just in case you change your mind.
With her 2 new hunting dogs, Serene became even more deadly. Soon, she had terrified the local predators so badly that if one of her sheep wandered away, a couple of bears were likely to lead it back to the flock just so they wouldn't get in trouble. One day on Mount Olympus, Artemis was chatting with her brother Apollo about the best mortal archers.
Serene is definitely in the top 5, Artemis said. She prefers the spear and sword, but she's amazing with the bow, too. I wish she would join my hunt, but she said she isn't ready to give up on men.
Apollo arched his godly eyebrows.
You don't say. Is she hot?
Brother, don't even think about it.
Oh, I'm thinking about it, Apollo admitted.
The next morning, Serene was patrolling the hills around her flock as usual when she felt the need to pee. That's another question I get asked a lot. Do demigods ever use the restroom? First, yes, duh. And second, why would you ask a question like that? Serene's dogs were guarding the other side of the herd, so she was by herself. She set down her weapons, since smart heroes do not go potty with sharp blades in their hands. She headed for the nearest clump of bushes. Unfortunately, a large male lion happened to be crouching in that clump of bushes, stalking Serene's flock. Serene spotted the predator and froze. She and the big cat stared at each other with mutual annoyance. The lion, because he wanted to eat sheep. Serene, because she needed to tinkle. She was empty-handed and doubted the lion would give her time to fetch her spear and sword, but she wasn't particularly scared. The lion growled like,
"Back off, lady."
"I don't think so." Serene cracked her knuckles. "You want those sheep, you have to go through me."
Which is not a heroic line you hear very often.
The lion sprang. Serene charged to meet him. "Kids, do not try this at home. Lions have sharp claws and fangs. Humans do not." Serene didn't care. She punched the lion in the face, then ducked as he swiped at her.
Just as the fight was getting serious, the clouds opened over a nearby hilltop. Serene didn't notice, but a golden chariot pulled by 4 white horses descended from the heavens and landed on the summit. The god Apollo gazed down at the 2 tiny figures fighting in the valley. With his divine vision, he could see Serene just fine. Her long, dark hair whipped around as she dodged the lion. Her graceful limbs were the color of polished bronze in the sunlight. Even in the midst of combat, her face was beautiful and serene. She reminded Apollo of a war goddess, and he should know he was related to several of them. He watched as Serene judo flipped the lion across the meadow.
"Wow," he muttered to himself. "There is nothing hotter than a chick wrestling a lion."
Maybe that was a sleazy thing to say. On the other hand, a lot of gods would have tried to intervene in the fight. They would have been like,
"Hey, little lady, you need some help with that big bad lion?"
Apollo could tell that Serene didn't need any assistance. He'd grown up with his sister Artemis, so he was used to self-sufficient women. He was happy to be a spectator.
"Man, I just wish I could share this with somebody," the god thought.
"Hey, I know."
Apollo's hilltop happened to be near the cave of Chiron, the wise center, who trained all the best heroes.
"Chiron will totally appreciate this."
Apollo snapped his fingers, and the centaur materialized at his side, a bowl of soup in his hands.
Hello, said Chiron. "Dude, sorry to interrupt your lunch," said Apollo. "But you have to check this out."
Chiron looked where Apollo was pointing. The lion swiped at Serene.
opening a line of bloodied gashes along her upper arm. Serene roared in anger. She roundhouse kicked the lion in the snout, then ran up the side of a tree, flipped over the lion's back, and landed behind him, flicking her hand like, "Bring it."
"Ah," said Chiron, "that's something you don't see every day."
"That lady has game, right?" Apollo said.
"Yes, I've heard all about Serene," said Chiron. "I wish I could train her."
"Then why don't you?" the god asked. Chiron shook his head sadly.
"Her father, Hypsius, would never allow it. He has old-fashioned ideas about the role of women. As long as Serene stays among the Lapiths, I'm afraid she'll never reach her full potential."
Down in the valley, Serene picked up the lion by his back legs, spun him around, and tossed him into a boulder.
"So," Apollo said, "what would happen if, say, a god were to fall in love with the girl and whisk her away to somewhere else?"
Chiron tugged thoughtfully at his beard.
"If Serene were taken to a new land, where the rules of her people did not restrict her, she could become anything she wanted, a hero, a queen, the founder of a great nation."
"A god's girlfriend?" Apollo asked.
"Quite possibly,"
Chiron agreed.
"And the mother to many heroes."
Apollo watched as Serene got the lion in a chokehold. She strangled the beast to death, then paraded around his carcass, her fists raised high in victory.
"See ya,"
Apollo told the centaur.
"I have a girlfriend to abduct."
Serene had just finished peeing and bandaging the cuts on her arm when a golden chariot appeared next to her in a huge ball of fire. Her sheep and cows didn't flinch. They figured this was just another predator that Serene would kill. Apollo stepped out of his chariot. He was dressed in his best purple robes, a laurel wreath across his brow. His eyes shone like molten gold. His smile was blinding. An aura of honey-colored light flickered around him. Serene frowned. "I'm guessing you're not from around here?"
"I am Apollo. I have been watching you, Serene. You are a vision of loveliness, a paragon of strength, a true hero who deserves more than guarding sheep."
"Guarding sheep isn't so bad. I get to kill wild animals."
"And you do it well," Apollo said.
"But what if I took you to a new land where you could found an entire kingdom? You could rule there as the queen, fight hordes of enemies, and also date a god." Serene thought about it. Apollo was kind of cute. He was better groomed than the Lapith men. He talked pretty, and that golden chariot was a sweet ride. "I'm willing to go on a first date," she decided. "We'll see how it goes. Where did you have in mind?" Apollo grinned.
"Ever heard of Africa?"
I was thinking more like that Italian restaurant in the village, but I suppose Africa works. Can I take my hunting dogs?"
"Of course."
"How about my sheep and my cows?"
"No room in the chariot. Sorry."
"We'll buy you a new herd when we get there." With a shrug, Serene whistled for her dogs and climbed aboard Apollo's chariot. They traced a fiery arc across the sky as they headed for Africa, leaving the poor sheep and cows to fend for themselves. Fortunately, Serene had killed every predator within a 50-mile radius, so they were probably okay. Apollo took his new girlfriend to the northern coast of Africa. They landed in the uplands of what is now Libya, where rolling hills were dotted with cedars, myrtle trees, and blood-red oleander. Springs bubbled from the rocks. Clear streams wound through meadows of wildflowers. In the distance, the coast was rimmed with white sand beaches. The sparkling blue sea stretched to the horizon.
"This is nicer than back home," Serene admitted.
"And it's all yours," Apollo said.
Serene couldn't resist being given her own country. She and Apollo became a hot item. They hunted together in the hills, ran along the beaches in the moonlight, and occasionally, just for fun, shot arrows at Hermes as he passed overhead delivering messages for the gods. Shooting Hermes in the butt was always good for a laugh. Back in Greece,
Apollo's oracle spread the word. Anyone who wanted a new life under a fabulous queen should travel to Africa and join the party. Soon a whole colony of Greeks thrived in that valley. They built a city called Cyrene, named after their queen, obviously. Their biggest and most important temple was dedicated to Apollo, also, obviously. The city of Cyrene became the first and most important Greek colony in Africa. It lasted through most of the Roman Empire. I hear the ruins are still there, but I haven't been. Every time I travel somewhere like that, I have to fight monsters and almost die, so I'll let you go instead and send me pictures. Apollo and the huntress Cyrene had two sons together. The older was Aristaeus, which means most useful. The kid lived up to his name. When he was young, Apollo took him back to Greece to train with Chiron the centaur. Aristaeus wasn't much good with a spear or sword, but he invented all kinds of important skills, like cheesemaking and beekeeping, which made him a real hit at the local farmers' markets. The gods were so impressed, they eventually made Aristaeus a minor deity. Next time you're playing Trivial Pursuit and you need to know the god of beekeepers and cheesemakers, you've got the answer. You're welcome. Cyrene's younger son, Eidmon, grew up to be a seer, since his dad, Apollo, was the god of prophecy. Unfortunately, the first time Eidmon looked into the future, he foresaw his own death. That kind of knowledge could really mess up most people, but Eidmon took it in stride. Years later, when the hero Jason was putting together a demigod dream team for his quest to get the Golden Fleece, Eidmon joined up, even though he knew he would get killed while aboard the Argo. He didn't want to miss his chance to die a hero. That's dedication for you. Cyrene was happy in Africa. She liked being the queen of her own city. But as the years passed, she began to get lonely. Her hunting dogs passed away. Her children grew up. Apollo visited less and less often. Gods are like that. They get easily bored with their mortal loves. To them, humans are like classroom gerbils. The first night you take one home, you're all excited and want to take good care of it. By the end of the school year, after you've taken the gerbil home 6 times already, you're like, "It's my turn again? Do I have to?" Cyrene never thought she'd get homesick for Greece, but she started to miss the good old days, wrestling lions, watching sheep, getting dissed by hairy Lapith menfolk. Cyrene decided she would go back to Thessaly one more time to check on her childhood friends and see if her dad was still alive. It was a long journey. When she finally got there, she learned that her father had passed away. The new king of the Lapiths didn't want anything to do with her. Most of her friends had gotten married and didn't even recognize her, or they died, since the Lapiths lived a pretty harsh life. Cyrene ventured into the wilderness on her own, roaming the old paths where she used to herd sheep. She missed her hunting dogs. She missed being younger. She felt hollow and angry, though she wasn't sure who she was angry at, and she thrust the point of her sword into the hard ground.
"That will dull your blade," said a voice at her shoulder.
Standing right next to her was a burly man in full combat armor. He held a bloody spear as if he'd just stepped away from a massacre for a quick coffee break. His face was handsome, the way a mountain is handsome, chiseled and unforgiving, majestic and potentially lethal. Painted on his breastplate was a rampant wild boar. "You're Ares," Cyrene guessed. The war god grinned. His eyes burned like miniature funeral pyres.
"You're not scared? I can see why Apollo likes you. But what are you doing with a pretty boy like Mr. Poetry? You're a warrior. You need a real man."
"Oh, I do, eh?" Cyrene yanked her sword from the ground. She wasn't scared. She'd grown up in these harsh lands, surrounded by blustering soldiers. She knew Ares. He represented her entire childhood. Everything she'd been whisked away from when Apollo took her. She wasn't sure whether she hated the war god or loved him. "I suppose you're going to sweep me off my feet," Cyrene snarled. "You'll take me away to some foreign land and make me a queen?" Ares laughed.
No. But if you're looking to remind yourself where you came from, I'm your guy. You can't escape your roots, Serene. You've got killing in your blood.
With a guttural shout, Serene attacked the war god. They fought back and forth across the mountainside, trying their best to cut each other's head off. Serene held her own in combat. Ares laughed and shouted encouragement. Finally exhausted, Serene threw her sword down. She tackled Ares around the chest. He embraced her with surprising gentleness. Next thing you know, they were kissing instead of fighting. I call that a lapse of judgment. In my opinion, cutting Ares' head off is always the best choice, but Serene was vulnerable and lonely. She was in the mood for something different, and Ares is about as different from Apollo as you can get. Serene stayed with the war god for many months. Together, they had a son named Diomedes, who became the king of Thrace, a country even farther north and twice as harsh as Thessaly. Ares was the Thracians' patron god, so it's no surprise they made Diomedes their king. The guy was a real sweetheart. When he wasn't waging war or torturing peasants, he raised horses that ate human flesh. Anytime he had prisoners or guests he didn't like, he tossed them into the stables until a guy named Hercules put a stop to that practice. We'll get to him in a couple more chapters. Eventually, Serene grew tired of the wild north. She returned to her city on the African coast and found Apollo waiting for her on the hill where they'd first landed in his chariot many years before. The god smiled, but his golden eyes were sad and distant.
Have a good time in Thrace?
Listen, Apollo. The god raised his palms.
You owe me no explanations. I was not as attentive as I should have been. I took you away from your native land and then left you. That was not your fault. But I fear our time together is ending, Serene.
I know. Serene felt relieved. She'd had 3 demigod children with 2 different gods. She'd done more in her life than most people ever got to do. Certainly more than most women of her time. She was ready for some peace and quiet.
Where do you want to live?
Apollo asked.
Thessaly or here?
Serene gazed at the hillsides dotted with myrtles and oleander. The green meadows, white beaches, and glittering blue sea. The Greek colonists were busy raising new temples to the gods in the city that bore her name.
I belong here, she said.
Apollo nodded.
Then I have one more gift for you. Ares was wrong. Your roots are wherever you decide they should be. I will bind you to this land forever. Your spirit shall always remain.
Serene wasn't sure about this binding forever stuff, but Apollo waved his hand and it was done. A ripple of warmth passed through Serene's body. Her vision cleared, as if someone had finally given her the right prescription glasses. Suddenly, the world was in higher definition. She could see wind spirits flitting across the sky, and dryads dancing among the trees, making the woods a tapestry of green light and shadows. The wildflowers smelled sweeter. The ground felt more solid beneath her feet. The babbling of the streams became a chorus of clear, beautiful voices.
What have you done? Serene asked, more amazed than frightened.
Apollo kissed her forehead.
I've made you a Naiad. Your great-grandfather was Oceanus. Your grandfather was a river god. You've always been part water spirit. Now your essence is tied to the rivers of this valley. You will live much longer than any mortal. You will enjoy peace and good health. As long as this valley flourishes, so will you. Goodbye, Serene. And thanks for the memories.
I'm not sure what Serene thought about all that. I didn't even know it was possible to turn a mortal into a nature spirit, but the gods are full of surprises. As Apollo promised, Serene lived a very long time. Eventually, she left her Greek colony and lived full-time in the river with the other Naiads, though occasionally she would rise to offer advice to her friends and family. Once, when her son Aristaeus lost all his bees, she helped him find them again. But that's a whole other story. Maybe we'll cover that in Percy Jackson's Really Minor Gods. Joking, guys.
Please don't give the publisher any more ideas. Nobody knows whether Serene eventually faded and died, or whether she's still hanging out in some stream near the ruins of her old city. I have to admire the lady, though. Anybody who can survive two godly relationships and come out sane is stronger than most heroes. Serene was able to reinvent herself several times. She embraced her new country and her new life, and after that one trip to Thrace, she never again looked back. That takes guts. Looking back can be deadly. Just ask Orpheus. Oh, wait, you can't. He got decapitated. Want to hear how? Sure you do. Let me tell you about the world's greatest musician and how he screwed up. Orpheus takes a solo. Good old Thrace, my favorite post-apocalyptic wasteland, where life was hard, priests made blood sacrifices to Ares, and kings raised horses that ate human flesh. Sounds like just the sort of place where a young boy would become a harp player, right? That's where Orpheus was born. Of course, the Beatles were from Liverpool, and Jay-Z is from the projects in Brooklyn, so I guess music can come from unpredictable places. The way Orpheus's parents met, that was even more unpredictable. His dad was a Thracian king named Oagrus. Good luck pronouncing that. Oagrus, maybe? When Oagrus was young and single, he liked partying and singing as much as he liked fighting. So when the wine god Dionysus and his drunken army rolled through town on their way to invade India, Oagrus welcomed them with open arms and a cup that needed refilling.
"You're invading a foreign country for no particular reason?" Oagrus asked. "I'm totally in."
Oagrus gathered his men and joined the wine god's expedition. At first, everything was rainbows and Chardonnay. Oagrus got along great with the wine dude's followers, especially the Maenads, crazed nymphs who liked to tear apart their enemies with their bare hands. A Thracian could appreciate that. Every night at the campfire, Oagrus drank with the Maenads and sang Thracian ballads. The guy had a rich baritone voice. When he sang a sad tune, he brought his listeners to tears. When he sang an upbeat number, he got everybody dancing. In fact, he sang so well, he attracted the attention of a muse. My brother Tyson is here. He thought I said moose. No, Tyson, the guy in the story did not attract the attention of a moose. Tyson is sad now. The nine muses were immortal sisters who oversaw different arts, like singing, drama, charades, dubstep, tap dancing, and maybe some other stuff I've forgotten. Calliope, the oldest muse, was in charge of epic poetry. She guided writers who were telling stories about heroes and battles and... You know what? I just realized I should have made a sacrifice to her before I started writing this book. It's totally her territory. Oops, sorry everybody. This book is not officially endorsed by the proper muse. If it explodes in your hands, my bad. Anyway, like all the muses, Calliope had a soft spot for music. From her apartments on Mount Olympus, she heard Oagrus singing as he marched east with the wine god's army. Calliope was so entranced, she flew down invisibly to check out this drunken warrior with the beautiful voice.
"Wow, what a singer!" Calliope sighed.
Even without proper training, Oagrus was a natural talent. He sang with so much emotion and confidence. It wasn't bad-looking either. As the army marched, Calliope followed, circling invisibly overhead like a large stealth seagull just so she could hear Oagrus sing every night. Finally, Dionysus reached India. If you've read my other book, Greek Gods, you know his invasion didn't work out too well. The Greeks crossed the Ganges River and got their butts handed to them by a bunch of fire-throwing Indian holy men. In the panic of retreat, Oagrus ran into the Ganges, but he forgot one tiny detail. He couldn't swim. Hordes of drunken warriors and Maenads trampled him as they tried to get away. Oagrus would have drowned if Calliope hadn't been watching. As soon as he went under, she dove into the river. Somehow, She wrestled him onto her shoulders and carried him to the opposite bank, piggyback style. That must have looked pretty odd, a lovely lady in white robes emerging from the Ganges with a big hairy Thracian warrior on her shoulders. Dionysus's army marched back to Greece in a dejected mood, but Calliope and Oagrus had a wonderful time. During the journey, they fell in love. By the time the Thracians got home, Calliope had given birth to a demigod son named Orpheus. The boy grew up in Thrace, which wasn't an easy place for a sensitive young musician. His dad lost interest in him when he realized Orpheus would never be a warrior. If you gave the kid a bow, he'd pluck a tune on the bowstring. If you gave him a sword, he'd drop it and scream,
"I hate sharp edges!"
The other kids teased and bullied and shunned Orpheus, until he learned to use his music as a defense. He gradually realized that his singing could bring the most hostile bully to tears. He could escape a beatdown by playing his reed pipes. His attackers would just stand there, enchanted, and let Orpheus walk away. Every weekend, his mom, Calliope, took him for music lessons with the other muses. Orpheus lived for those visits. His immortal aunts taught him everything they knew about music, which was basically everything. In no time, the kid outshone his teachers. Orpheus had his mom's finesse and divine skill. He had his dad's raw talent and mortal edginess. The muses had never heard a voice so beautiful. They gave Orpheus a bunch of different instruments to try: a drum set, a French horn, a 67 Telecaster. Orpheus excelled at all of them. Then one day he found the instrument that would make him famous. The only problem? It belonged to a god. One weekend, Apollo visited the nine muses to get their input on his new musical, 25 Awesome Things About Me, a sequel to 20 Awesome Things About Me. Apollo played them a few songs on his lyre, while Orpheus sat in the corner of the room, listening in astonishment. He'd never heard a lyre before. No mortal had. Back then, Apollo had the only one in existence. Hermes had invented it out of a tortoise shell, two sticks, and some sheep tendon strings, because Hermes was a boss. He'd given it to Apollo to avoid jail time for cattle rustling, long story, and the lyre had become Apollo's prized possession. After a few songs, Apollo set down his instrument and gathered the nine muses around a piano at the other side of the room. While they were deep in discussion, trying to figure out the nine-part harmonies for the big finale, Orpheus walked over to the lyre. He couldn't help himself. He picked up the instrument and strummed a chord. Apollo shot to his feet. His eyes blazed with anger. The nine muses dove for cover because nobody picks up a god's toys without permission. Only two things kept Apollo from blasting the kid to ashes. First, Orpheus was holding the lyre. Apollo didn't want to damage it. Second, Orpheus launched into the most incredible song Apollo had ever heard. The boy played as if the lyre were part of his own body. His fingers ran across the strings, coaxing out impossibly sweet melodies and counter-melodies. The nine muses wept with joy. Apollo's anger evaporated. Orpheus's music was full of mortal pain and sadness. No god could have made music so raw. Apollo appreciated that. Twice before, Zeus had punished him by turning him temporarily human. Apollo remembered how difficult that had been, his divine spirit trapped in a fragile body of flesh. Orpheus's music captured the feeling perfectly. Orpheus finished his song. He looked up sheepishly at Apollo.
"I'm sorry, my lord. I couldn't help myself. You may kill me now. I have played the lyre. My life is complete."
He knelt and offered the instrument to the god. Apollo shook his head.
"No, my boy. Keep the lyre. I'll make another one."
Orpheus's eyes widened.
"Really?"
"You deserve it. Take the lyre. Make music across the earth. Teach others to play. Just do me a favor. Don't teach them Stairway to Heaven, okay? I'm really sick of that song."
Orpheus bowed and groveled and thanked the god. He did exactly what Apollo asked. He traveled the world teaching others to make lyres and play beautifully. He collected songs from every land. He even journeyed to Egypt, where he added the music of that ancient country to his repertoire. He perfected his own playing and singing, and whenever he found someone trying to learn Stairway to Heaven, he took away their instrument and smashed it against a wall. Orpheus became so talented, his music could bring entire cities to a standstill. He'd walk through a marketplace playing his lyre, and everyone would freeze. Merchants would stop selling. Pickpockets would stop stealing. Chickens would stop clucking, and babies would stop crying. Mobs of people would follow him out of town just to hear him play. They'd walk behind him for hundreds of miles until finally they'd look around in a daze and think,
"I live in Egypt. What am I doing in Jerusalem?"
Orpheus just kept getting better. Wild animals were powerless against his music. When he walked through a forest, lions gathered around and rolled over so he could pet their bellies while he sang. Wolves rubbed against his legs and wagged their tails when he did that song they liked, "Hungry Like the Wolf." Birds flocked silently in the trees, listening as Orpheus played, hoping they could pick up some tips to improve their singing. Finally, Orpheus's music became so powerful it could even affect the environment. Trees moved through the earth, scuttling on their roots like crabs, so they could get closer to his lyre. Boulders wept condensation when he sang. Rolling stones followed him down the road. Probably the Rolling Stones, too, because those dudes look old enough to have known Orpheus. Rivers stopped in their course to hear him. Clouds anchored themselves overhead so they could have nosebleed seats for his concerts. Nothing in the entire world could resist Orpheus. His music was like the gravity of a sun, drawing everything toward him. When he wasn't teaching music, he did a bunch of heroic stuff. For instance, he sailed aboard the Argo. But we'll get to that in the chapter on Jason. Stay tuned. Get it? Music? Stay tuned? Well, Tyson thought it was funny. Orpheus became so famous, he couldn't go anywhere without attracting a mob of fangirls and fanboys. He sang and hearts melted. He won awards. He got marriage proposals from all over and so many views on his YouTube channel that the site crashed. He was bigger than Elvis, bigger than Bieber, bigger than, insert name of whatever boy band is popular this week. Sorry, I don't keep track. Just to escape his own fame, Orpheus returned home to Thrace, because people there didn't care about him. Funny how that works. No matter how important you get out in the world, the people you grew up with are still like, yeah, whatever.
"Hi, Dad," Orpheus would say. "I had to come home to get away from my millions of fans."
"Fans?" his dad grumbled. "Why do you have fans?"
"Well, my music can stop rivers and make trees move, and one time an entire city full of people followed me several hundred miles to hear me play."
"Bah," his dad scowled. "You still can't hold a sword properly."
While in Thrace, Orpheus spent most of his time with the followers of Dionysus, since at least they appreciated good party music. Orpheus helped organize the Dionysian Mysteries, which were a big spiritual festival with lots of wine, music, and drama in honor of the god. Not that Dionysus needed any more drama, but I guess the music was a nice addition. But even in Thrace, Orpheus had crazed fans. During the festivals, the maenads would get drunk and start flirting with him. Since Orpheus only cared about his music, he wouldn't respond, and the maenads would get angry. A few times they came close to rioting and tearing him apart. His mom Calliope decided that for his own safety, Orpheus should get married. Maybe that would make his fans back off. She talked with Apollo, who happened to have an eligible young demigod daughter named Eurydice. Calliope arranged a backstage pass for Eurydice at Orpheus's next concert. The two of them met, and it was love at first sight, or at least by the end of the first set. As the daughter of Apollo, Eurydice had music in her blood. She understood Orpheus immediately. They chatted all through intermission back in Orpheus's dressing room. After his final encore, Orpheus brought Eurydice on stage and announced that they were getting married. His fans wailed and ripped their hair out, but Eurydice looked so beautiful and Orpheus looked so happy that the crowd graciously refrained from stampeding the stage. For weeks, social media buzzed about what a cute couple they were, though nobody could decide what their ship name should be. Ordice? Eurypheus? Their wedding was attended by all the beautiful people and gods. The nine muses provided the music. Apollo officiated. Dionysus was the flower boy. Okay, I might be making that up. Hymenaeus, the god of marriage ceremonies, showed up in person to lead the procession, though strangely, he cried as he escorted the bride down the aisle. His clothes were funeral black. His sacred torch was supposed to burn cheerfully, but it only sputtered and smoked. The guests wondered about that. It was a pretty bad omen for the marriage to come, but everybody was scared to ask him about it. As for Orpheus and Eurydice, they were too in love to notice. At the reception, the groom sang so sweetly to his bride that the whole audience broke down in tears. They should have had the most romantic honeymoon ever. Unfortunately, a stalker ruined everything. You probably think I mean a stalker for Orpheus, but nope. Turns out his wife had a crazed fan of her own. For years, a minor god named Aristaeus had been trying to get Eurydice's attention. Maybe you remember Aristaeus from the last chapter, Serene's kid? If not, don't worry about it. He was the god of beekeeping and cheesemaking. Not exactly a major player. Anyway, he had a huge crush on Eurydice, but she didn't know he existed. Aristaeus went crazy with despair when she married Orpheus. Eurydice was making a terrible mistake. Why would she marry the best musician in the world when she could marry a cheese god? Aristaeus had to make her see reason. One afternoon during the honeymoon, Eurydice and Orpheus were relaxing in a beautiful meadow in the forest. Orpheus decided to play his lyre for a while, because even musical geniuses need to practice, so Eurydice went for a stroll by herself. Big mistake. Aristaeus followed, lurking in the bushes. He waited until Eurydice was half a mile from the meadow, then he jumped out in front of her and yelled, "Marry me!" What was Aristaeus thinking? I suppose his only role model for women was his mom, Serene, and she wasn't exactly the romantic type. She'd won the affection of her first husband by killing a lion. She'd won her second husband by trying to cut his head off. Maybe Aristaeus figured if he acted aggressive, Eurydice would finally notice him. She noticed him, all right. She screamed and ran away. 9 times out of 10, if somebody jumps out at you and yells, "Marry me!" screaming for help and running away are an excellent idea. In this case, however, Eurydice would have been smarter to punch Aristaeus in the face. He was a cheese god, after all. He probably would have cried and fled. Eurydice panicked. She didn't look where she was going. She stumbled through some tall grass, straight into a nest of poisonous snakes. A viper sank its fangs in her ankle, and the young bride instantly collapsed. By the time Aristaeus caught up with her, she was turning blue. He spotted one of the vipers slithering away, the most lethal kind of snake in all of Greece. Its venom would already be in Eurydice's heart.
"Oh, bee butts," Aristaeus muttered.
He wasn't a very powerful god. Maybe he could have saved her by turning her into a queen bee or a nice wedge of monster. But before he could act, he heard Orpheus calling her name. The musician must have heard her screams. Aristaeus didn't want to take the blame for Eurydice's death. Nobody would ever buy his honey or cheese at the farmer's market again. He did the cowardly thing and ran. Orpheus stumbled across the body of his beloved. His heart shattered. He cradled her and sobbed. He tried to sing her back to life. When that didn't work, he begged the vipers, which had gathered at the sound of his voice, to bite him so he could follow his wife to the underworld. The snakes just looked at him,
No, we like you. You sing pretty.
In a daze, Orpheus buried Eurydice in the meadow where they'd shared their last joyful moments. Then Orpheus took up his lyre and wandered aimlessly, pouring out his sorrow into his music. For days he played songs of unbearable heartache. Think about the saddest moment you've ever experienced. Now imagine that sadness multiplied times 100. That's how Orpheus's music felt as it rolled over you. Entire cities wept, trees oozed tears of sap, clouds unleashed torrents of saltwater rain. On Mount Olympus, Ares cried on Hephaestus's shoulder. Aphrodite and Athena sat on the sofa together in their pajamas, binging on chocolate ice cream and bawling. Hestia rushed around the throne room, offering everyone boxes of tissues. Orpheus played the longest, saddest solo in music history. While it went on, nobody could do anything. The entire world mourned. But even that wasn't enough for the musician.
Eurydice's death was not fair. I will go to the underworld, Orpheus decided.
When somebody you love dies, it's a hard thing to get over. Believe me, I've lost some good friends. Still, most of us learn to keep going. Most of us have no choice. Orpheus couldn't let Eurydice go. He had to bring her back from the dead. He didn't care about the consequences. Maybe you're thinking, bad idea. This will not end well. You're right. On the other hand, I understand how Orpheus felt. I've come close to losing my girlfriend more times than I want to think about. If she died, I'd do everything I could to bring her back. I'd grab my sword, march into Hades' palace, and I'd probably act just as recklessly as Orpheus did. Only I wouldn't be singing. I don't sing. The underworld has many entrances, fissures in the earth, rivers that plunge underground, the bathrooms in Penn Station. A weeping woodland nymph directed Orpheus to a large clump of boulders that concealed a tunnel into Hades' realm. Orpheus played his lyre, and the rock split asunder, revealing a steep path into the earth. He descended into darkness, playing so sweetly that no ghost or daimon dared to stop him. At last he came to the banks of the River Styx, where the boatman Charon was loading the newly dead aboard his ferry.
"Oi," Charon told him. "Clear off, mortal. You can't be here."
Orpheus launched into a soul-piercing rendition of Daydream Believer. Charon fell to his knees.
That was our song. I was a starry-eyed teenage daimon. She was a sweet young zombie girl.
He broke down sobbing.
Fine.
The boatman wiped his eyes.
Come aboard. I can't resist your horribly sad music.
As they crossed the River Styx, Orpheus played such mournful tunes that some of the dead souls chose to leap overboard and dissolve themselves. Maybe they didn't like golden oldies. At the gates of Erebus, Orpheus strummed a chord and the iron gates swung open, trembling on their hinges before the power of his lyre. The giant three-headed guard dog, Cerberus, crouched and snarled, ready to tear apart the mortal intruder. Orpheus sang the theme song to Old Yeller. Cerberus howled and rolled over, whimpering. Orpheus passed through the gates. He traveled through the fields of Asphodel, waking the spirits with his music. Normally they were gray, chattering shades who couldn't remember their own names, but Orpheus's songs brought back memories of the mortal world. For a few moments, they took on human shapes and colors again. They wept tears of joy. The sound of the lyre reached the fields of punishment. The three furies, Hades's most heartless enforcers, forgot their duties. They sat in a circle and cried their demonic eyes out, then had a group therapy session where they shared their feelings and complimented one another on their fiery whips and their bat wings. Meanwhile, the damned souls got a reprieve. Sisyphus sat on his hill, his boulder forgotten. Tantalus could have finally reached food and drink, but he was too busy listening to the music to notice. The guys on the torture racks were like,
"Excuse me, I'm supposed to be flayed alive over here? Hello? Anyone?"
Orpheus played his way right into the palace of Hades. The heavily armed zombie guards didn't try to stop him. They followed him through the corridors, making dry, grunting noises as they tried to remember how to weep. In the throne room, the king and queen of the dead were having lunch. Hades wore a yellow lobster bib over his flowing dark robes. Bits of crustacean shell littered the dais around his skeletal throne. Persephone nibbled on a luminous subterranean salad from the palace garden. Her dress was yellow and gray, like the sun behind winter clouds. Her throne was woven from the bare branches of a pomegranate tree. As the intruder approached his throne, Hades rose.
"What is the meaning of this? Guards, destroy this mortal!"
But it was hard to look menacing with butter dribbling down his chin and a cartoon lobster on his bib. Orpheus launched into a Duke Ellington number, stalking monsters. Hades' jaw dropped. He sank back into his throne.
"Oh," Persephone clapped. "Darling, it's our song."
Hades had never heard Duke Ellington played so beautifully, so raw and painful and true. As if this mortal musician had distilled Hades' life with all its grief and disappointment, all its darkness and solitude, and turned it into music. The god found himself crying. He didn't want the music to stop. Eventually, Orpheus's song ended. The zombies dried their eyes. Ghosts sighed in the windows of the throne room. The lord of the underworld composed himself.
"What? What do you want, mortal?"
His voice was brittle with emotion.
"Why have you brought this heartbreaking music into my halls?"